Welcome to the Blue Side Podcast, brought to you by Cambridge University Science Magazine. In each episode, we delve into the intersections between science, technology, and society, featuring guest researchers who present a fresh perspective on their work, what goes on behind the scenes, and the latest developments in their field.
In today's episode, we will be speaking with Charlotte Milbank. Charlotte is a PhD student in epidemiology and geography at the University of Cambridge. Her research explores the ways in which wild foods, such as bushmeat, insects, wild fruits and vegetables, can be used to support the health and nutritional security of rural communities. In particular, she is looking at the use of wild foods by Indigenous peoples in northeastern India. In the wake of the COVID-19 pandemic, Charlotte was actively involved in epidemiology-related science communication. She has written multiple articles on zoonotic diseases, how they are linked to human behaviour, and how we might mitigate their spread. She has an incredibly popular Instagram, Epidemiology, which has nearly 400 posts simplifying COVID-19 science and research and what it means for the UK population. The page closed recently with almost 60,000 followers, but off the back of this, Charlotte now works with some NHS regional teams on their COVID-19 communications. So it's really great to have Charlotte with us today to talk about her research and her PhD, zoonotic diseases and the COVID-19 pandemic. So firstly, Charlotte, what sparked your interest in wild foods and sustainable food security and the research that you're doing with your PhD at the moment?
Thank you for having me on the podcast and thanks for that introduction. So in terms of what sparked my interest, I first came across wild foods during my time as an undergraduate. I got a position as a research assistant working in Burkina Faso in West Africa. And I was working on a project which was looking at the nutritional contributions of caterpillars to human diets and also the caterpillars' socioeconomic value to local agriculture and other livelihood activities. And I think that with caterpillars and other insects being just one example of wild food, this experience really opened my eyes up to the possible contributions of wild foods to diets and health, particularly in remote communities. And then also the fact that these contributions to diets, the contributions of wild foods to diets, have largely been overlooked in food policy. Following on from this time as a research assistant, I then went on to write my undergraduate thesis on wild food consumption in Burkina Faso. And then I was fortunate enough to be able to build on this work to develop a far larger PhD project looking at the contributions of wild foods to nutritional health in Indigenous peoples' communities. So that's kind of where it all came from. In the meantime, I've been able to work with the UN Indigenous Peoples Unit, and I supported their work in the run-up to the recent UN Food Systems Summit. And I guess that kind of has further cemented my interest in, wild foods and sustainable food systems and Indigenous peoples' health.
Yeah, that's really interesting to hear about your experience in West Africa as an undergraduate and what you learnt about those communities using caterpillars as wild foods. Mm. Was there a particular aspect about that experience that really motivated you to continue looking into this area? Was there something in particular that you thought this really needs to change, or if we could learn more about this particular aspect, then something could really be improved and therefore this is what I really want to do my PhD work on?
Yeah. I think for me, it was the way that, in mainstream sort of agriculture and food policy, nature and food production is largely seen as like kind of competing interests. And I think what struck me in Burkina Faso was actually the sort of interdependencies between nature and agriculture production. So one of the things about the caterpillars is not only were they a really important source of protein for local communities, but the local agriculture also benefited from having the caterpillars there. Farmers would deliberately keep the trees that the caterpillars lived on. They would keep those trees in the agricultural fields because they knew that the birds would then come and eat the caterpillars. The birds would excrete on the crops below, and that would fertilize the crops. And so there were these kind of like interlinkages between, improved yields, human nutrition, ecological health, biodiversity. And I think that was really interesting for me, to sort of acknowledge those interlinkages and kind of question the the kind of mainstream narrative around this sort of separation between food production and I guess like what nature, if that makes sense.
Yeah, because I guess it's not until you kind of see it for real, it's not, those sort of linkages aren't something you'll see, because they're not going to be, I mean, on the ground is always the best place to see these sort of things, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And you see, like you say, on the ground, you see how much value these caterpillars really have. I mean, I guess in the UK, you kind of think, oh, insects are just a novelty, like maybe we'll eat them for fun or whatever. But actually, when you're on the ground, you see that these are such important sources of protein and how much, you know, people depend on like agriculture for their livelihood and sort of that sort of thing.
Yes, and I can imagine it's very nuanced to the location and ecology and ecosystems in the particular area you're looking at, and the culture and local practices of the local people.
Yeah, definitely.
So also wanted to talk to you about another focus of your PhD, which has been the risks associated with using wild foods, and in particular zoonotic diseases. So wondering if you could tell us a bit more about what a zoonotic disease is and when they occur.
Yeah, so I guess a bit of a leap from wild foods to zoonotic diseases. But I suppose in my PhD, I'm both trying to understand the nutritional contributions of wild foods to diets, but especially in the context of the pandemic, we can't look at the possible benefits of consuming wild foods without also acknowledging their potential risks. And one of those risks is zoonotic spillover. COVID-19 obviously being one example of a zoonotic disease, a disease which originates in animals and can spill over to humans. So what is a zoonotic disease? I briefly touched on it then. It's diseases that normally exist in animals but can jump to infect humans in what we call spillover or spillover events. How much do you want me to go into this?
As much as, okay. Just keep going. It's good. It's good stuff.
Zoonotic spillover has been documented as originating in various domesticated and non-domesticated wild animals. In terms of when spillover occurs, spillover from animals to humans requires quite specific conditions. So it requires the coexistence of an animal host species, so an animal that can be infected by a given pathogen or disease-causing organism. B, it requires sufficient amount of that disease-causing organism or pathogen within that animal, and then C, it requires the animal to come into contact with a susceptible human, so a human that can again be infected by that given pathogen, and then we obviously need that pathogen to be able to survive within humans if human-to-human transmission is going to occur. I think maybe it's important to note here that A, not all zoonotic pathogens are that harmful to humans, and B, while spillover itself might be quite a common occurrence, the takeoff, so broader transmission resulting in larger outbreaks with human-to-human transmission, that's far more rare, and it requires quite specific conditions for kind of zoonotic outbreaks to occur on a wider scale as well.
Yeah, I was going to ask something about how common is this? Because obviously COVID is a big example of something that's kind of taken off, but you know, we don't have that every year, two years,
absolutely.
Do we?
Absolutely. So I think the actual question of how common it is, it's a real mystery. There are a lot of parts of the world where animal-to-human contact is fairly common, and spillover occurs quite commonly, but because of, lacking resources, or particularly around sort of diagnostics, they might go underreported. And it might only be that we detect these spillover events once outbreaks reach like a certain threshold size, and after they've already done kind of considerable damage. We can kind of sometimes retrospectively identify spillover events, so we can, for example, look at antibody levels within certain populations, and that could indicate that spillover has taken place. But I think we actually don't really know how common this is taking place. We just see the bigger ones, and the places where, you know, surveillance is more active.
Yeah. So have there been any considerable learnings from recent zoonotic diseases that we've experienced, for example, COVID-19 or SARS or AIDS? Have there been significant advances in what we know about them and how we can mitigate their spread or prevent them entirely?
Yeah, definitely. So maybe if I just like sort of attempt to quantify the number of spillover events that occur from different sources, because it might just help us to put it into context. Researchers suggested that one of the biggest sources of zoonotic spillover actually comes from land use change. So that includes things like deforestation, habitat fragmentation, agricultural development, urbanization, and then also from conventional agriculture and food industry change. And these sorts of changes, they will, for example, affect the distribution of animals, animal host species. It will affect the change, like the behavior of animals, the breeding patterns of animals, as well as the breeding patterns and distribution of the pathogens themselves. And then I guess all of these things will also bring animals and humans into sort of different levels of contact. So I think we need to sort of sometimes remind ourselves that actually the biggest source of spillover is this sort of anthropogenic land use change. When we look at bushmeat consumption, wild meat consumption, which is often vilified in, you know, political popular media, they only are thought to account for about 3% of zoonotic disease spillover events. So it's disproportionately kind of like focused on in the media, when actually it's thought to only be kind of account for a smaller proportion of overall spillover events. But obviously, I do focus on the wild meat consumption and the risks from that. So in terms of what we can do to reduce the risks of these diseases emerging, I think, first of all, to touch upon maybe what we shouldn't do to mitigate these risks. One of the common reactions to the COVID-19 pandemic and then previous outbreaks like Ebola and bird flu has been to just totally ban the consumption of wild meat and wild meat trade. In theory, these should, you know, be effective in preventing spillover events because they minimize animal-human contact. But actually, they can often have unintended consequences. For example, pushing wildlife hunting underground where it becomes harder to regulate, but also threatening like the food security of communities that might rely on wild meat more. So for example, the communities that I work with. In some of the recent work that we did, we looked at ways that we could come up with maybe more targeted approach to spillover prevention from wildlife consumption, rather than these sort of total bans. And we kind of came up with three core areas that might be better to focus on. The first was looking at increased pre-spillover surveillance. So looking at trying to assess sort of where animals and humans might be in close proximity, where are contacts potentially more risky, what species might be higher risk than others. So really, really trying to identify these hotspots, these spillover hotspots before spillover actually takes place. So that was kind of risk prevention area number one. The second was around sort of education and awareness, because knowledge around zoonotic disease is often poor and quite variable across sites. So interventions that might work with local communities to improve understanding of, you know, this species, this animal species is higher risk to consume and this one's lower species. So maybe thinking about consuming the lower species might be a safer way forward. Those sorts of things. And then thirdly, there might be a case to make for more targeted bans to reduce spillover risk from domesticated meat or wild meat. So for example, we know that bats are huge, like harbor huge numbers of zoonotic diseases. And so targeted bans around bat consumption might be relevant in certain sites at certain times of year, for example. So those things might be good to focus on, but I would come back to what we were talking about earlier and sort of say that whilst there are unarguably risks of disease spillover from wild meat consumption, policies that focus only on wild meat consumption are really only kind of one strand of solutions that we need to be looking at. We do need to recognize that land use changes are a major driver of future pandemics and disease outbreaks. And I guess, yeah, we can't overemphasize that enough.
Yeah, that's really interesting that land use change, as you say, contributes significantly to increasing the risk of zoonotic diseases. Mm. I can imagine that there is, in usual circumstances, a lot of intergenerational knowledge that is passed down that's designed to be used in a specific context. And then when there are significant land use changes, deforestation, habitat loss, climate change, urbanization, etc., that can really change what information is needed to utilize the resources around. And then that's when I can imagine these educational facilities become really important. Would you say that that loss of intergenerational knowledge is a significant component of this?
Yeah, no, definitely, I would imagine so. The communities that I work with definitely had their own sort of risk mitigation practices when they were hunting, and rarely reported. I mean, studies need to be done to sort of quantify the level of risk involved. But in terms of risk perception and risk mitigating practices, they had those practices in place to sort of minimize actual contact with animal bodily fluids, for example, and rarely reported any experience of disease. So I think, like you say, there are kind of practices that are and knowledge that is handed down within certain communities. And maybe with land use changes and broader sort of socioeconomic and political changes, these sorts of this sort of knowledge is being lost.
Yeah, cool. So also wanted to ask you about your recent trip. I know you went to India for 5 months. So wondering if you could tell us a bit more about that and what sort of research you were doing over there.
Yeah, absolutely. So after a long interlude during the pandemic, I was finally able to make it out to India in January, and I spent 5 months there and recently got back. And what I was doing there was working with local indigenous communities known as the Khasi people, and understanding their use of wild foods, quantifying it. So understanding, you know, what is your regular consumption of wild foods, both sort of on a daily basis and also kind of across the seasonal calendar, understanding their health and how wild foods might be contributing or not to local health. And then there was also sort of kind of like a qualitative element to my research as well, trying to understand, you know, what motivates you to consume wild foods, what makes it more difficult for you to consume wild foods, how are these practices changing in the long term, just so we can sort of understand if we wanted to intervene, for example, to derive local foods policies based on wild foods, what are the kind of benefits and challenges to doing so? So on a daily basis, I was living and working amongst these communities and just sort of conducting these methods.
Is there a particular reason you chose to look at those communities, or is there kind of just a general kind of thing like that?
Yeah, no, it's a good question, one that I get asked quite a lot. I think the boring answer is that it was logistically easy. I think with the constraints of the time constraints of a PhD, you kind of are forced to go to places that you do have good contacts. And I was lucky through my work with the UN to establish connections with an organization working on the ground in the northeast of India that could support me during fieldwork. I was lucky that this site was also incredibly apt in terms of the questions I was asking. The population of the state that I was working in is majority indigenous, which is quite rare in terms of the Indian context. And wild food is still being consumed. So that was another kind of tick, like in that sense. The region also faces its own sort of nutritional and health challenges. So that again has sort of like pertinence to my research questions.
Are you working within an interdisciplinary team when you're doing this research?
So here in Cambridge, I'm supported by a couple of supervisors, one within the Department of Geography, and I've got some advisors in the Department of Geography. And then I also have a couple of supervisors within epidemiology. So within Cambridge, I have like an interdisciplinary team that's supporting me. Within the field environment, so in India, I was working with a local organization that I would say was fairly interdisciplinary. I was working with people that had done, you know, degrees in like ecology and the biophysical sciences, but also social scientists. So I was well supported there when I was there as well. But I think what was also quite important was that I was very much working with an organization that was indigenous led. So it wasn't just, you know, this problem of extractor research and ivory tower sort of research, I was very much like trying as much as possible to be quite kind of inclusive in my approach.
Yeah. So now that you're home, what are the next steps?
Next step, I've got back on the back of 5 months of data collection, I now have to analyze all that data. So that is the major big step. Writing up the thesis, and then I am planning another trip back to India later in the year, and that will coincide with wild hunting season and insect season, so I think it'll be quite an important time for me to be there and sort of just witnessing, not necessarily collecting data, but just witnessing these events take place.
Yeah, so that data analysis, what does that look like on a practical level in your field? What are you doing day to day? What is the grind like at the moment?
At the moment, it's just a lot of data cleaning and coding, I'm afraid. Nothing too exciting. But essentially, I'm going to eventually be trying to disentangle, hopefully statistically significant relationships between wild food intake and various health outcomes.
So what kind of outcomes do you want to see come from the work that you're doing as part of your PhD?
It's a great question. I think we all have high and potentially overambitious hopes for our own research, but I guess the overall hope for my PhD is that the findings might have important practical implications for supporting the nutritional and health outcomes of Indigenous peoples who sadly do suffer disproportionately from malnutrition and other health conditions compared to their non-Indigenous counterparts. So yeah, implications for how we can support the food security of Indigenous peoples, whilst also balancing, I suppose, the concerns of the public health community around zoonotic spillover, and also concerns from the conservation community about environmental degradation and potentially over-harvesting of wild food products. That's kind of my PhD, but then more broadly, I guess I hope that as an interdisciplinary researcher myself, I can add impetus to calls for greater interdisciplinarity in our approach to emerging global challenges, of which food security is just one, but challenges like climate change, pandemic preparedness and response, all of these things will require interdisciplinary collaboration and recognition, I guess, that human health and the health of our environment and animals is so closely interlinked. So I think, yeah, that call for kind of greater interdisciplinarity is something that I'd like to contribute to.
Yeah, so I also really wanted to ask you a bit about some of the science communication work that you've done. I know that you've written a number of articles about topics like zoonotic diseases and wild foods and topics relating closely to your PhD. But I also know you had a very popular Instagram account, which was about the COVID-19 pandemic, which you started in March 2020. So just wanting to know more about your journey with that, and firstly, how and why you started the page.
Yeah. So Epidemiology was a social media account I started on Instagram just before the first lockdown in March 2020, which was clearly a time of huge uncertainty for all of us. I was aware of the growing volume of information circulating, and not just misinformation, but also of new unfamiliar terms and jargon, things like flattening the curve, reproductive number, incubation period, all these terms that were previously kind of unheard of amongst the general public. And I felt that more could be done to try and kind of cut through the noise and translate these new phrases into layman's terms to hopefully make the pandemic a bit more tangible and to help people make sense of it all. It went on to be a lot more successful than I ever could have thought it would be. I think there were clearly gaps in public health communication elsewhere. And also, I think a massive thirst for knowledge amongst the general public that hopefully I was able to sort of satiate in some ways. In terms of the journey until now, I think the focus definitely changed over time of what I was talking about. I very much started with just some basics of epidemiology, just because I felt that was sort of what we needed to start with. And then I was very much attentive to the changing news, changing headlines, changes in policy, and really tried to like break down what was happening, demonstrate the science, for example, behind the headlines, behind new policy changes. For example, when the vaccine trials started to come through, I was able to explain sort of how these trials worked, what their results were showing. When new variants emerged, again, I could explain what they were and what we knew, what we didn't know. And then I was also really lucky to collaborate with researchers at the London School of Hygiene Tropical Medicine and Imperial College London, who had designed the roadmap out of lockdown, and able to kind of discuss with them, you know, what were the process behind designing this roadmap? What do that your model show about what might happen as we kind of ease out of lockdown? Those sorts of questions were really exciting to explore. I think the main aim was that I hoped always to kind of provide an unbiased perspective as much as possible, and acknowledging the uncertainties involved. And I think that my audience valued that honesty, especially at times when, you know, science and politics appear to be kind of so heavily intertwined. I think that honesty was sort of valued.
Yeah, no, I think you're so right. And yeah, I think, I guess, with especially with the COVID pandemic, there were so many elements to it that were affecting everyone, but were concepts that were so new to everyone, and, you know, things that were, you know, can be quite difficult to comprehend, like the idea of exponential growth. You know, I think that was something that is quite difficult to think about in practical terms. And yeah, and there was definitely such a desire for impartial knowledge from everyone, really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. And I think especially in the context of a world where people get their information from such diverse sources, I think having a couple of maybe trusted accounts that you can go to is sometimes helpful.
I think also it helps having it short and sweet, because, you know, you don't want to read through, like, you know, long articles trying to explain what these terms are. Whereas if someone just says in a couple of sentences, you're like, okay, now I know. You know, it might not be the proper, full definition, but at least it's enough. So if you see it again, you'll be like, okay, that's what they're meaning.
Yeah, 100%, 100%. Yeah, so I would always, like you say, try and kind of keep it in a succinct manner and then include like references that if people wanted to read the full articles or whatever, they could go into that. Yeah.
Obviously, you know, you've said you've worked with the people from the UN and the NHS. Is like, what kind of thing do you want to do next? I know it's a bit of a very massive question. Most of course, you know, it's going to change. It is a stressful question. Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah. But I'm intrigued.
Yeah. I think I would like to stay in research for a little bit longer. I think that's my current plan. Maybe a couple more years working in this kind of interdisciplinary space. Exploring these questions a bit more broadly, but still hopefully working alongside people at the UN so that my research can have more kind of practical policy impact. And then I think once I've done the research and hopefully gained more kind of credibility as a scientist, I'd like to kind of maybe move into that UN or more policy space.
Well, thank you so much, Charlotte, for coming on to our podcast today and telling us about your PhD work and all the really interesting work that you've been involved with. I've learned a huge amount. Thank you so much.
It's been very, very interesting.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode. We hope you enjoyed it. We had a really interesting chat with Charlotte, and it was fascinating to learn more about her research and her recent work in India. You can find all of our previous episodes on Anchor or whatever platform you like to use, and can get in touch with us via Twitter at BlueSciPod or send an email to podcast@bluesci.co.uk. Until next time!